was still in the chapter on monastic training called Polishing the Shell, and this section is called Samana. And it starts off with a quotation from Sutta number 40 and in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the lesser discourse at Asapura, the Chula Asapura Sutta. Samanas, that is how people perceive you. And when asked, what are you? You claim, we are Samanas. So, with this being your designation and this your claim, you should think, we will practice the way of the Samana with integrity, so that our designations will be true and our claims accurate, so that the services of those whose robes, alms food, lodging, and medicinal requisites we use will bring them great fruit and benefit, and so that our going forth will not be barren, but fruitful and fertile. Thus, monks, should you train yourselves. The word samana, usually translated as recluse or contemplative, is generally taken to be derived from a word meaning ascetic striving. Longpo preferred to render it as, quote, one whose mind is at peace, unquote. At the time of the Buddha, it was the name given to members of the various religious sects who had abandoned their caste identity and the life of the householder. In the Buddhist tradition, samana has been used as a synonym for both monk and true monk. In the sutta passage above, the Buddha refers to its first meaning as a conventional designation and urges monks to constantly bear in mind their responsibilities to act in conformity with it. As true monk, quote unquote, the term samana encompasses all the qualities that monks should aspire to. So within the sutta teachings and in the Buddha's time, there was a distinction between samanas and brahmins, so that whereas the brahmins were more like the kind of priestly they had a kind of pastoral role in society, giving advice, performing ceremonies, carrying out rituals, and so forth, and were often householders. So Brahmin priests were often householders. The samanas were the yogis, meditators, wanderers, and such like, so that you often get this distinction between the samanas and the Brahmins. And whereas Brahmins very definitely were in the caste system, they were... And depending on people's perspective, either the Kshatriyas, the warrior nobles, or the Brahmins were the topmost caste, then the samanas had very deliberately abandoned caste. So they had part of the undertaking of the samana life, the monastic life and renunciate life, was a laying aside of caste distinction. So it was irrespective whether one came from a worker caste or an untouchable caste or a warrior noble caste, that all of the caste distinctions were cast aside, pun intended, were kind of dropped when you took on the life of the samana. It's also, I believe, interestingly enough, the word samana in Pali, or shramana in Sanskrit, is related to the English word shaman, from like the northern European and sort of Russian tradition, the shamans. So that shamanic realm and the realm of the samana, they're connected in that kind of being outside of society and having that kind of role of a contemplative or renunciate or someone who's outside of the householder way. And also, Ajahn Jayasaro uses the word monk and monks very, very generally here. I mean, he's living in Thailand and writing in Thailand very much within the Thai system. But it's as one hears the words, I'll read accurately what it says in the book, but it's good to be translating that to be referring to monastics, whether they happen to be male or female. But so when the word monks is used, you can render that internally as referring to all monastics generally. Longpo encouraged monks to dwell upon and consciously cultivate the perception of themselves as monks or samanas by constantly reminding themselves of their role and responsibilities and the goals of their monastic life. By doing so, he wanted them to cultivate a new identity as a skillful means, not an ultimate truth, that would distance them from their former identities in the world and serve to strengthen the mental factors of wise shame and fear of consequences. This perception was to give them a wholesome sense of pride in their lineage and of being upholders of an ancient tradition. It was meant to inspire them with the guiding ideals of Sangha life. A summoner's life was characterized by the sincere effort to study and practice the threefold training of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, in order to realize liberation and to inspire others by their conduct. And this is Lumpur Cha speaking. Firstly, resolve to have victory over yourself. That's the main thing. You don't need victory over anything or anyone else. If you're always thinking of defeating other people, you're losing the battle of practice. True practice is based upon reaching the point where you know how to achieve a constant victory over yourself. Ultimately, if you achieve victory over yourself, then you achieve victory over all things. Establish this principle constantly in your mind. In a memoir, Ajahn Khemadamo summarized, "And the purpose of our life, we were never allowed to forget. We are monks, not for gain and fame, not for status and worldly advancement, but in order that we may have the best possible chance of facing our defilements, all those spoiling influences in our hearts and minds, seeing and understanding them and casting them out to achieve a secure and lasting peace, the real happiness of Nibbana." In one discourse, Lumpur challenged the monks. "What do you want? Wealth and respect? Rank and honors? Material things? We are monastics. The Buddha taught us not to aim at such things. If you're intent on pleasure, on fun, on an easy life and good food, on material things, then it would be better if you hadn't become a monk at all. It means you're lying and deceiving the lay people. If you want all that, then go out and make a living as a layperson. There's no point in coming to live here in the forest, going without sleep and eating only once a day." Reflect on this deeply. Ask yourself the question, what did I come here for? What am I doing here? You've shaved off your hair, put on the ochre robe. What for? Go ahead, ask yourself. Do you think it's just to eat and sleep and live a heedless life? If that's what you want, you can do that in the world. Take the oxen and the buffalo out to the fields, come back home, eat and sleep. Anyone can do that. If you come and act in that neglectful, indulgent way in the monastery, then you're not worthy of the name of monks and novices. Life as a monk offered great opportunities for cultivation of the path, but without the willingness to overcome old habits, it was easy to founder. Again, Lumpur is speaking here. If you accept the basic principles and try to follow them, you'll have a practice. But if you don't accept them and just follow your likes and dislikes, you'll be heading for disaster. Even if you live as a monk for 20 or 30 years, you still won't know the flavor of the Buddha's teachings. You'll be like the fisherman who goes every day to fish in a pond without any fish in it. However diligent such a fisherman may be, he's always disappointed. Day after day, he casts his net and brings in nothing. Recollection of the great masters could bring the mind back onto the right track when it wandered. Their attainments could be emulated through the power of wise effort. Again, Lumpur Cha speaking. Read the biographies of the great teachers. They are singular people, aren't they? They're different. They think carefully about that difference. Train your mind in the correct way. You don't have to depend on anyone else. Discover your own skillful means to train your mind. If the more skillful means were unable to stem the flow of deluding thought, then a more direct approach was needed. Whatever did the job. Once the immediate danger had been averted, a more nuanced approach could be returned to. If the mind starts thinking of worldly things, then quickly subdue it, stop it, get up, change your posture, tell yourself not to think about those things. There are better things to think about. It's essential that you don't just mildly yield to those thoughts. Once they've gone from your mind, then you'll feel better. Don't imagine that you can take it easy and your practice will take care of itself. Everything depends on training. So in this this section, what Lumpur's pointing to, and I feel is very, very significant, is that sense, particularly of rousing the initiative from within yourself. One of the dangers and difficulties of a religious institution is that we become institutionalized. You know, there's a system. You just follow the system, and you learn the ropes. You learn what the schedule is, and you sort of join in with the pattern. And then it becomes something that is automatic. It becomes a convenient, predictable way of life, even though it can be quite austere or demanding in some respects. Then that institutionalization, just following along with the pattern, and that, because it's called meritorious, it's called a good thing, it's called sort of noble, sort of, that's what it says on the label, then there can easily be that sense of, well, I'm doing it because it's a good thing, but then there's been a drift from what maybe started out as a very sincere and personal initiative. It's drifted to you do it because you do it, and everyone else is doing it, so you do it because you want to be like everyone else. And so I speak from personal experience in this, and so that the Yilumpo's words here are quite challenging or quite pushy in many respects. But what it's trying to do is to help, at least how I read it, it's helping to turn that attention back and say, what am I doing here? You know, am I just following the form and being a good sort of shaven-headed robe wearer? Or am I breathing life into the form? And that's a theme also that Lumpur Sumedho would dwell upon over and over again, particularly in the early days of Amaravati. He would kind of pound away at this theme, and particularly this expression of breathing life into the form was something that Lumpur Sumedho would use very, very often as an encouragement. And that even though it's, as I said, it's a challenge, it's demanding to live a celibate life and to be following a rigorous routine and to do without many distractions. But even within that, we can become just one who has learnt a set of behaviours. You've learnt the moves, and you're just, in a sense, going through the motions. You might go through the motions very well. You might be a good performer. But the encouragement is to say, bring it to life and to be recollecting, well, what am I doing this for? Why do I shave my head? Why do I put on these robes? Why do we call these things important? So in a sense, it's more challenging. It's easy to be obedient and just to follow a system. There's something in us that says, at least I just know what to do because everyone else is doing it. This is what's expected. So I just follow along with this and I feel great. But it's more than that. If we're going to use this form to be liberated, then we have to be actively taking that initiative. And I remember, probably Ajahn Sundra would remember this as well, and we're the only old team members, the only 30-year-plus ones in the room. But I remember Lumpur Sumedho, I think, sitting right here in the sala, giving a talk from the Dhamma seat, and he said, the last thing I want you to do is to turn into a bunch of bloody Buddhists. Like, kind of spitting the word out. Like, it's the most kind of disgusting concept. Bunch of bloody Buddhists. Like, it was a kind of dreadful mistake that we were all likely to make. And of course, most of us sitting there think, I thought that's what we were supposed to be doing, you know. But it was a very good point, because it's not just learning the Buddhist behaviors. It's not just learning the words and the forms, but Lumpur Sumedho, like Lumpur Cha, is very good at getting your attention in those kind of skillful ways. That it's, oh right, of course, that's not the whole thing. So we're not just Ajahn Jayasaro puts it here, that you're not just taking on the robes or the monastic training or living in the monastic domain simply to cultivate a new identity, and that's exactly what Lumpur Sumedho was saying. And again, he would make this kind of comment, like, you don't become a nun or a monk in order to be a nun. That's not the point. Sometimes I would say that in Dhamma talks or in teaching here in England or when I was in the States, you say, I'm not a monk because I want to be a monk. And people go, huh? Yeah. And you say, well, the point is not to have a new identity. It's not just a monk identity instead of a layperson identity. The point is that the monastic life, the robe, is like a raft. It's a means to get from the shore of dukkha across the flood to the shore of no dukkha. That's the point of it. And so that these are challenging teachings because they are challenging that in us which wants to sort of nestle back and just be a sort of professional monk or professional nun, and kind of that's what you do, and it's makes it simple. You don't have to kind of look outside of that. But the point is not to be merely a fresh identity, but to be a form which helps the mind to see beyond every kind of identity. So the next section is called the marvel of instruction, which is an expression that the Buddha used. So there's two kinds of marvels or two kinds of miracles. There's the miracle of psychic power, like reading people's minds or flying through the air or walking through walls or such like. There's the miracle of psychic power, and then there's the miracle of instruction. And he says of these two, the miracle of instruction is the superior. So the fact that somebody can say some words, and that through hearing those words, then the quality of wisdom, of insight can be catalyzed, can come into being, and the heart can be liberated. Like kind of the saying on the one prana night, you know, the Buddha gave this short 15-minute talk on the fire sermon, and 1,000 people became arahants. That's a miracle. That just the sound of the Dhamma teachings can bring about that radical change of heart. And the Buddha said that's far more of a miracle. Just the impact of hearing a sound and understanding a meaning, and that causing a change of heart, that's a far greater miracle than flying through the air or reading people's minds or walking through walls and such like. So the first section here is called modes of teaching. The body of Lumpo Cha's teachings is generally considered to consist of the material recorded on reel-to-reel tapes and audio cassettes and then transcribed and printed in books, originally in Thai and subsequently translated into many other languages. But for his monastic disciples, the formal discourses captured by those audio recordings, reproduced in books, were only one part, and perhaps not the most important part, of what they received from him. Lumpur's most powerful teaching, for those who lived with him, was arguably not what he said, or even what he did, but who he was, and who he was perceived to be. His disciples saw him as the living, visible proof that there was truly an end to suffering, and that it could be achieved through practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Seeing him, sensing him nearby, gave them the strength of mind to endure the difficulties of the training. In the beginning, it was often faith in the teacher himself, rather than in specific, profound teachings he imparted, that kept young monks in the robes. Charisma is not an inevitable fruit of liberation. Some fully enlightened beings prefer a life of obscurity and project a quiet and unobtrusive air that makes them almost invisible. Lumpur was not such a figure. He was, in all meanings of the word, an impressive monk. His presence impressed itself effortlessly upon those around him. One Western monk said of him, "If any human being deserves to be called a force of nature, quote unquote, it's Lumpur." It's also interesting that he was quite small. He was only like about 5'2", 5'3". I don't know what that is in meters, but not very much. And yeah, he was physically quite tiny. His feet were like size 3 feet. His hands were tiny. He was, and many people remark on this, that when you were close to him, and Lumpo Sumedha would physically tower over him. He's like, you know, more than a foot taller than Lumpo Cha. And he said it was weird because even though he's shorter than me, but he's bigger than me. So he would have that simultaneous experience of, how come I'm looking down at him when he's twice the size I am? So that there was that weird kind of perception that you would get around him, that he was physically very small, but enormous. The Buddha referred to the teacher as the Kalyanamitta, or good friend. He was not a guru to be worshipped, but a wise and compassionate guide on the path. He inspired strong confidence through his impeccable practice of the Vinaya at the monastic observances. He practiced what he preached and did not ask his disciples to do anything that he would not do himself. He taught monks to spend every spare moment on the walking meditation path, and he would often be seen pacing up and down on his own path. The sense of solidity and unwavering purpose in the way he lived his life transmitted itself to his disciples. The feelings of faith, love and devotion, respect and reverence that Lungpo inspired in those around him provided the emotional context in which his oral teachings were received and played an important part in the effect that they produced. Teaching ability is as little an inevitable outcome of liberation as charisma. Inarticulate, unenlightened monks usually become inarticulate, enlightened monks. Lungpo, however, had always been a fine and fluent speaker. As Kalyanamitta to a large group of monks and lay supporters, his ability to transmit the teachings in a clear and rousing manner appropriate to his audience became renowned. That's a point that Ajahn Jayasaro made earlier on, that eloquent and witty people become eloquent and witty arahants, and inarticulate and tongue-tied people become an inarticulate and tongue-tied arahants. So it doesn't make you automatically a fine teacher. Ajahn Jan, a fine Dhamma teacher in his own right, found the talks so gripping he could enthuse about them half a lifetime after his first exposure. So this is Lumpur Jan. His portrait is up on the wall there over the trolley. So he was one of the very early disciples of Lumpur Cha. So he was there in the sort of groundbreaking days of Wat Bapong back in the mid-50s. So he's one of the survivors of Lumpur's extraordinarily demanding regimes in that era. So this is Lumpur Jan speaking. It was 1988-89, he spent a year living here in this community. Lumpur gave talks almost every day. If someone had misbehaved, then the talk might go on for hours. His voice was loud, resonant, very powerful. You felt how determined he was that his listeners should understand. It was as if he wanted his words to wear down his disciples' defilements until they were as smooth as a drum skin. His talks were on many different levels. He would talk in one way to the Sangha, when there were no lay people present, and another way when there were, and another way if he was addressing the lay people directly. He would tell us off, but not angrily. He never ran out of words. The talks were incredibly forthright and bold. He wasn't afraid of anyone. Listening to him talk, you were never bored. You were enthralled. And what he said hit home so well that even to this day, his words are still ringing in my ears. As monks walked out of the Dhamma hall after one of Lumpur's talks, it was rare not to hear voices exclaiming that parts of the talk were specifically aimed at them. How marvellous it was that Lumpur should have chosen to speak on that very subject that was currently obsessing them. Monks would speak of labouring for some time over a doubt, and then how the talk addressed that problem directly and in detail, putting their mind to rest. Ajahn Anaik said, "His words pierced to your heart. Most people's doubts about meditation would be answered during his formal talks. He would deal with exactly the problem that was frustrating you, no matter how subtle it might be. If you listened closely to every word he said, you'd find it exactly right for you. That was his genius. It was truly profound." In some cases, perhaps the majority of them, the belief monks held that Lumpur was talking to them personally may be put down to the flowing, unstructured nature of his discourses. The number of defilements is finite, and in a long talk, it's unlikely that any one of the major ones will go unmentioned, at least in passing. Indeed, Lumpur sometimes referred to casting his net, quote-unquote, with more general observations about mental defilements that hauled in all those who were affected by them. However, there were also occasions where monks were particularly moved by passages in talks that took an unexpected deviation from the flow of his discourse. Beyond dispute was the way in which the formal Dhamma talks set the tone in the monastery. In the days following a particularly inspiring talk, there would be a tangible buoyancy in the air. In the days after an admonitory exhortation, so when he was scolding people, even the colours of the forest could seem subdued. Lumpur would spend time every day longer as he got older and less active, sitting on a wide wicker seat underneath his kuti, making himself available for anyone who wished to speak to him. During the day, most of Lumpur's conversations were with lay visitors, but monks and novices acting as attendants would enjoy the opportunity to listen to him answer his guests' questions and offer reflections. Monks with free time would often sit down in a corner and listen. Sometimes Lumpur would shoo them away. No need to sit around here. Go away and meditate. At other times, he would permit them to stay. In the evenings, after the group chanting and meditation had ended, a number of monks would gravitate to Lumpur's kuti in order to listen and learn, and sometimes just to sit quietly with their eyes closed in meditation. On one occasion, a Western monk sitting listening to Lumpur answering questions with short, succinct answers, concise but profound, and after the guests had left, he exclaimed, "Lumpur, that was just like Zen!" And Lumpur replied, "No, it wasn't. It was just like me." This is very typical. Not all of Lumpur's teachings have been preserved. Occasionally, he would speak privately with monks whose meditation practice had reached an advanced level. The advice given during those conversations has never been revealed. It's worth bearing in mind that the Dhamma talks that have been recorded and transcribed, for all their richness, are restricted to Lumpur's public teachings. Although Lumpur was always available to disciples struggling with doubts about practice, he did not necessarily answer the questions he received, or if he did, not in the way that they expected. He was not interested in spoon-feeding the Dhamma. Sometimes, sensing that no answer he might give would serve any useful purpose, that it would simply increase the questioner's confusion or conceit, he would refuse to answer at all. This was not always to the questioner's liking. Lumpur would shrug. If they had even a glimmering of understanding, they wouldn't ask a question like that in the first place. I saw that happen a few times. He continued, "The more you explain, the more doubts you'll create in their minds, because they haven't practiced to a point where they can understand. If they practice, then they'll know for themselves and be free from doubts." Inexperienced meditators were like small children who did not as yet understand the world around them. Again, Lumpur speaking here. When the child sees a chicken, he asks, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" When he sees a duck, it's, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" Then he sees a pig, and again it's, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" Eventually, the father can't be bothered to answer. There's no end to the questions, and because to the child, everything is new. In the end, the father just replies, If he were to answer every single question, he'd die of exhaustion. The child isn't tired at all. It never stops asking. Eventually, the problem disappears by itself as the child gets older and more experienced. In the same way, if you are devoted to reflection and persevere until you comprehend the way things are, then problems will gradually clear up by themselves. So this was something that was, even though I couldn't understand the Thai language, you could see Lumpur operating in that way very, very often. And it seemed to be quite regularly, he would not answer the question in the terms that the person asked the question. He would always seem to receive it and then take it to pieces and rearrange the pieces and hand it back to the questioner. And so often he would ask a counter question, or he'd say, he'd receive what they said, but more it was as though he was more addressing where the question had come from in the person, as it says here, that he can see that the person's asking, but they don't really have any kind of understanding, so any sort of answer that a systematic answer that he gave wouldn't have any usefulness. So he would, in a way, address where the question was coming from in the person rather than the detail of the question. And sometimes the way he would work with it is he'd help the person to, in a way, answer their own question. He would get into a dialogue with them. And over and over again, the person would find that they would answer the question themselves, and that with an understanding that they didn't realize that they had before. And I don't know if Ajahn Jayasaro refers to it here in this narrative. I haven't read the whole book yet myself, but one of the comments that Lumpur made that I found extremely potent and really interesting to reflect on, when somebody asked him, well, how do you do that? You seem to, over and over again, someone's got a question, they're full of doubt, they don't understand something, and then you get into this dialogue and you help them to answer their own questions. So how do you do that? Because you do it over and over again. And then he made the comment, if they didn't already know the answer, they couldn't have asked the question in the first place. So you just help them to go back to where the question came from, and that's where they find the answer. You follow that? So that's a really interesting concept, that if you didn't already have a kind of unconscious understanding of what's happening, you couldn't have put the question. But it's like you understand it, but you don't realize you understand it. So it sort of helps to lead you back through the undergrowth, through the forest of your own thinking, and back to the source of the question, and then the person would be able to say, clarify what feeling they had for the situation in the first place. So before carrying on, any questions, reflections?
I just wanted to, it kind of reminded me, when we were at Chitta's in the early years, there was a kind of standard that was even before you came, you know, to England. Immediately you got a sense that the less question you ask, the better you were. We did not know that, you know, consciously, but you have, yet there was a kind of sense that if you only ask a question every 2 or 3 years, you're really old. You know, it's like you don't quite know where to pick it up exactly, but, you know, Lumpur brought it straight away to England. He didn't wait for us to kind of, you know, hesitate on things, basically. You picked it up straight away. If you don't ask questions and just kind of roast in there with your own kind of problems and difficulties, the more it cooked and cooked and cooked and you suffered, and great, you know. And then, as you say, you don't ask questions, you know, then that you're really gung-ho somehow.
So any questions? Thank you for the setup. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. That also, that particularly listening to Lumpur Sonata, like in the early days at Chitta's, because he'd often give a couple of talks a day, early, like in the morning reflection or at tea time, having, and that you'd something would cross your mind, and then you'd kind of ask yourself, well, what would Lumpur say? Well, he was Tanajan, was how he addressed him in those early days. He was still quite. Not that senior, actually. Ajahn Sumedho was only, when Chithurst opened, he was about 12, 13 reigns. So we used to, it was Tanajan Sumedho. So what would Tanajan say? And then almost invariably, you kind of, okay, oh yeah, right. They then ask stupid questions. Or.
And then one of the things, there's some question you'll never ask, because you know what you get back, how idiotic you can be to ask such a question. Like, when I went to Thailand and spent time with Ajahn and Nam, I remember, you know, one nun was with me and said something about Sotapanna. One of the books who probably knew him, he said, Ajahn said, I'm not asking like that. She's coming from Amaravati or Chitta. You know, this is not the kind of question you would ask in this place. Mm-hmm. You know, don't ask idiots. I mean, of course, now it's talked about. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's you know, chapter reviews and this and that about Sotapanna. And it was kind of funny. Some question with Lumpur Sumedho you'll never ask, because you get blasted back, you know, in a kind of wise way. You get a response that really shook you.
Indeed, yes.
How stupid to ask such a question.
I remember someone at one of the Sunday afternoon talks here, somebody asked, Venerable Sumedho, which do you consider the superior path, the path of the Arahant or the path of the Bodhisattva? And Lumpur was sitting here, and it was like this kind of tidal wave across the sala. It was, you could feel everyone kind of recoil, because there's this sort of delivery from the heart, the gut, that said, that kind of question is asked by people who understand absolutely nothing about Buddhism. That, and that's a very toned down version of it. It was. You could feel the room shaking for a. I'm not sure what happened to the individual, but they, you could be sure they didn't ask that question again. So thank you. So to continue. Longpo praised disciples who treated their problems as challenges to be overcome. He wanted monks to learn how to develop their own skillful means to deal with difficulties, rather than allowing themselves to become overly dependent on him. Most doubts about meditation practice were resolved through becoming aware of the nature of doubt itself, seeing it as a conditioned phenomenon and not identifying with it. This was one reason why he was not in favor of the daily interviews popular in meditation centers. They took too much responsibility away from the meditator and deprived them of opportunities to grow in wisdom. The Thai term for such interviews between meditation teacher and student is sop arom, literally mood inspection. And Longpo once joked, "Even dogs know their own moods. When they feel hungry, they howl." So sop arom. So he was bringing the, because it's quite a sort of polite term. It's like a technical term, sop arom. You know, to have an interview, but Longpo putting, you might be aware that dogs have a very different social status in Thailand than they do in the West, where people tend to exalt their dogs, often think of their dogs as spiritually superior to most of their friends and family. But in Thailand, comparing a meditation interview with dogs howling is making a definite statement about what you think in the usefulness of that kind of formal interview structure would be. His advice was to keep putting as much effort as possible into formal meditation. In the body of practices, Longpo speaking, in the body of practices that make up monastic training, sitting and walking meditation constitute the backbone. Those whose practice is going to be strong are the ones who don't neglect their walking meditation, who don't neglect their sitting meditation, who don't let slip their sense restraint. Each monk had a walking meditation path, some 20 to 30 paces long, by the side of his kuti. As soon as the daily meal and clean-up was completed, the monks were encouraged to return immediately to their huts to put their robes out on the line to air and to begin to practice walking meditation. For those who did that regularly, again Longpo is speaking, their walking path is worn into a furrow. I've seen it myself many times. Monks like that don't feel jaded or stale in their meditation. They have energy. They have real power. If you all give that kind of attention to your practice, it will go well. The training that Longpo provided his monks was a well-rounded one. Monks learned how to meditate and were encouraged to meditate a lot. But they also learned the Vinaya in great detail. They also learned how to give the precepts to lay people, how to chant blessings, and how to conduct funeral rites. They learned how to build and take care of the monastery and how to teach. When the time was ripe to begin their own monastic community, they had been furnished with all the basic tools that they would need to survive and flourish. Longpo would sometimes speak about the qualities of a good teacher. He must understand the way his disciples' minds work, just as a carpenter must understand the particular qualities of each kind of wood. Or he must be like doctors who know their patients, the cause of their illness, and the appropriate medicine to cure the condition. Or he would say, it's like fishing. If the fisherman casts his net at random over the whole of the river, he won't get any fish. But he must wait until a fish breaks the surface of the water and then cast his net at exactly that spot. To teach, you have to look to see how much the student can take, he said, to look at what's just right for them, because it's the just rightness that is the Dhamma. Longpo's ability to pitch his teachings on the just right level was so unerring that it convinced many monks, after private conversation with him, that he'd been reading their minds. This may well have been true, but in most cases, the effectiveness of his words may be as easily attributed to acute observation based on long experience. Ajahn Suryon gave an example. The Western disciples liked to see Longpo laugh and smile and give them opportunities to ask questions. If he didn't do that and seemed indifferent towards them, they'd find it oppressive. So Lungpo would give them lots of attention, frequently asking them how they were, how their practice was going, and so on. The Thai monks didn't expect the same kind of personal attention. If he saw that Thai monks understood his teaching well enough, he didn't say much to them, but he'd find appropriate skillful means to teach monks who were dull or unintelligent. With monks of an angry or negative disposition, he would speak humorously or give examples that emphasized kindness and gratitude. Once they felt relaxed, the minds of these monks would become receptive to what he was teaching and experience some joy and uplift in the Dhamma. As a result, they would feel inspired and their practice would progress. Ajahn Anaik recalled another of the similes Lumpur used to describe the qualities of a teacher. So this is Lumpur Anaik speaking. He said, "How could I be a teacher if I didn't understand the way my disciples' minds work? It's like the owner of a banana plantation. If he doesn't know all about bananas, their trunks, their leaves, their fruit, then how could he run a plantation? It's all just a matter of body and mind. It doesn't matter whether it's young monks, old monks, monastics or lay people. If their minds have fallen under the power of defilement, then there's no difference between them." So it's also that's a comment that I've made many, many times in the past, is that, and I believe that, I'm quoting Lumpur from my memory, was when someone made that same kind of observation. It's like, Lumpur, you know, you seem to be able to know exactly what people are thinking, and you give these teachings that are appropriate to everybody, you know, all the time. You know, can you read people's minds? And he said that wasn't what he was doing. He said, if you're observant, you can know everything that you need to know about someone just by watching the way that they walk into the sala, or the way that they walk across the central area of the monastery. He said, and as it's mentioned a few times in these narratives, when somebody arrived newly in the monastery as a lay person or as a visiting monastic, he would just watch them for 2 or 3 days and just see how they operated, see whether they were the ones who were always there first for a meeting, or they sort of always came a bit late, or they were, when there was a work project, would they show up early and then leave early, or would they kind of join in at the back and always be looking out to help everyone, or were they out front kind of making a big fuss of how much they're doing, and were they able to handle the tools, were they not able to handle tools, and so forth. So he would just watch and just see how people operated. And then through that attuning and observing how people were, oh, okay, you know, this one, you know, she likes to be out front, or you know, she likes to be at the back, or this one thinks he thinks he's really good at building, but he actually can't even hold a hammer. So that very keen, but not very practical. And so he would he didn't like keep a book where he's kind of scoring points or anything, but he would just watch and then. Would use situations, it says here from Ajahn Suryon saying, yeah, if you saw someone was angry and hot-tempered, or they kind of get upset with someone and frustrated and they stomp off the work site, okay, that's a hot-tempered one. Okay, so that person needs a bit of encouragement or ways to calm them down. Or somebody who's always sort of, you know, sad and depressed or self-critical, then you say, oh, this one needs cheering up. And so that it was really just that quality of being observant, paying attention, and then letting the teachings arise circumstantially. So in a way, one of the best ways of describing Lumpur's teaching method was that it was a situational teaching. And earlier in these readings, I think I was mentioning how some Westerners got a bit paranoid that they, and one particular one who's extremely forthright, American Waropano, he was convinced that Lumpur was actually sitting down and planning situations with other monks to kind of set up teaching programs for Waropano, to kind of rig situations so that it would be particularly difficult or particularly challenging for him, that set him up so that it would be a lesson that Lumpur and the others have all decided, oh, this is what Waropano needs. Okay, you come here, you sit over there, and then you arrive 5 minutes later, and then you say this, and I'll say that. And he was convinced that Lumpur was kind of plotting this whole carefully worked out program to get him to have some sort of specific teaching. And Lumpur thought it was hilarious. He said, you know, that he would think that you think I spend all that time plotting with other monks just for you? You know? Yeah. Says, you're very conceited to think I would spend so much time, you know, just having discussions about what to teach you. And he persuaded him, said, no, it's just the circumstance, you know, that somebody said, oh, we need a couple of junior monks to go to Suan Gloria, and I looked around and there you are. So I thought, oh, Warapanya, that's a good, that'll be good for him. You know, there's nothing more to it than that. So the this sense of being observant, and also his ability to just sort of bring forth things that were appropriate to time and place, and he was particularly gifted that. And also sometimes you could, because he was doing that, his mood would seem to change extremely quickly, so that he might be talking to someone and being incredibly funny and charming and encouraging. And you think, oh, you know, Lumpur's such, he's so sweet, he's so kind, he's so friendly. And then somebody else comes along and he might just sort of turn to them and there's a totally different person there saying, yeah, what do you want? And then go back to telling this hilarious story about a squirrel trying to learn how to, you know, a baby squirrel trying to learn how to jump through the branches of a tree and, you know, falling on the ground. And you think, well, what just happened? And it was not, again, that, none of that was constructed or thought through. It was just, okay, this is what this one needs, so being friendly and charming and encouraging, and this one needs a clap around the ear. You know, he would be able to move from one particular mode or form of expression moment by moment. And similarly, this is one of the things that I was continually surprised at when the times I was sitting around and listening to him teaching, keeping quiet, not asking any questions, but just sort of watching how he operated, that sometimes, you know, someone would speak in a certain way and you think, oh, this monk is really going to get, he's going to get blasted. That's a really, you know, stupid thing to say, you know. Asking about stream entry or something, oh, Lumpur's really going to let this one have it. And then, to your surprise, rather than letting that person have it, he would be very technical, or he would go into a very sort of warm and sort of detailed engagement with that person. He'd go, oh. And then someone else, you think, oh, this is one of the old villagers, someone Lumpur has known since they were kids together, and he's going to be kind of very, very friendly or very easy. And then, bam, he would kind of be really, really short or abrupt with them. Like, oh, my goodness, what happened there? So you could almost always, what you thought he was going to do, he wouldn't do. And not because he's just trying to be clever or just unpredictable, but he would operate totally from intuition and just and was very, very non-reactive, so that you couldn't predict how he would handle the situation. So that yesterday I was talking about the first morning after my novice ordination, which was particularly miserable. So, you know, launching on my sort of the path to nirvana as the most miserable morning of my life. But the morning after my bhikkhu ordination, again, I was the ordination was in the evening at Wat Pa Phong, and stayed overnight. And then there was an invitation to eat at one of the villagers' houses in Bangkok, Lumpur Cha's home village, just about a couple of kilometers away, about a mile away or so from Wat Pa Phong. So a whole bunch of us who've been newly ordained and some of the senior people went along with Lumpur. So there was this invitation to eat at the house, and you're sitting in a long line. So I'm down at the end of the line. Lumpur is up at the front. There's probably about 11 or 13, 15 monks in the line, and Lumpur sitting at the front. And one of the villagers was, as you would expect, the people were usually very, very quiet and very restrained and speaking very politely to the Ajahn and such. And there was this one guy who was just kind of ranting. He was really loud and just sort of going on and on and on. And so all the food is gathered, everyone else is sitting on the mats gathered around in the, so one of these little houses in the village up on stilts, so we're all sitting on this this open area in the middle of the house. And this guy was going on and on and on, and Lumpur just was sitting there and kind of watching him, listening, and he's thinking, oh, Lumpur's going to really give it to him and tell him to, you know, keep quiet, you know, everyone's waiting, the, you know, it's time to offer the food. And this guy's so out of order, and he's really, really noisy, and doesn't he realize that everyone's waiting for him? And Lumpur was just completely cool. There was no reaction. He wasn't waiting for the guy to finish. He just went on and on and on and on, like a quarter of an hour, half an hour, 45 minutes. It's going on and on. And we're all sitting there, and it's like Lumpur's not waiting for him to finish. And then you realize that in my mind, it was, kept waiting for Lumpur to kind of jump in and say something, or you know, ask him to be quiet, or say, well, this ceremony's got to happen, and or the food's getting cold, or the. Well, that, you know, this time to begin the offering, but he didn't. He just made this this enormous space for this person to be exactly as they were, and it became clear that the guy was a bit deranged. But everybody knew that. All the other people there were all sort of family or friends of him. And they know, it's Pornu. He's like this. He's really excited, and so he's just blasting away for half an hour or 45 minutes. And so that's what we're doing. We're just listening to Pornu do his thing. So here we are. And you realize that the way that Lumpur operated and the kind of teaching is then, it's the teaching for everyone else who's gathered there that says, are you waiting for this to be over? is something else supposed to be happening? Or can you just be here and be present with everyone and just listen? And then, sure enough, the moment came where so paused for breath, and then it moved on, and then the meal offering happened, and you know the guy hadn't been scolded or made to feel bad and you know, Lumpur made absolutely nothing of it. It was just that's how this person is, and so you just expand to accommodate that. So just to give a little bit more on this section. Given Lungpo's profound understanding of the relationship between the body and mind, it was not difficult for him to recognize his disciples' dispositions. He would observe them walking, standing, sitting, lying down, changing posture, eating, bowing, working. He would notice their alertness and attention to detail when performing duties for him. Every action told him a story, just as I was saying. The Buddha once said that just as integrity is to be known through long acquaintance and fortitude through adversity, wisdom is to be measured by speech. Lumpur observed how monks conducted themselves and how they expressed themselves. Meanwhile, Ajahn Liam, who's now the abbot of Wat Bapong and was the second monk for many years with Lumpur Cha, Ajahn Liam observed Lumpur. This is Lumpur Liam speaking. Mostly he would gauge monks' knowledge from how they spoke. He would observe their reflections on Dhamma and the wisdom that was revealed in their speech. At the end of the rains retreat, he would have all the monks and novices take turns to ascend the Dhamma seat and talk about their experiences during the retreat to the laypeople. This was one method he used to see how people's practice was going. Did they possess the qualities of a Dhamma speaker? You weren't to have any desire to give a talk, because then Lumpur considered that you were just following craving. He wanted to see who had a sense of responsibility. He wanted us to train in that way to see if we had any particular abilities. If we hadn't had to do that, he would never have known. So that's still a tradition in many monasteries. When I arrived from America here, I suggested we might have that as something to do at the end of the rains retreat, but the assembled venerables said no. But personally, I think it's a great idea. All of the members of the monastic community take a few minutes, half an hour or so, 20 minutes or however long, to get up onto the Dhamma seat and give a talk, share their understanding. But it was made clear to me that that was not a popular idea when I arrived here. So if I was going to survive as the new abbot, I thought, okay, diplomatically speaking, I better drop that one for the time being. Maybe after my first decade, I'm still alive, can introduce that. Lumpur would say that once you can ground your mind in the present moment, everything is ready to teach you. Insights into the three characteristics arise naturally in the mind. Often he would share his own reflections with those around him. His disciples would treasure these teachings and observations not so much because they were especially profound, although sometimes they were, but rather it was because they were grounded in a particular event in which the listener participated, and so took on an immediacy, an intimacy, and context that was not easily forgotten. Ajahn Pasno, for example, recounted how one morning while returning from alms round, a pair of lizards copulating in a roadside tree fell off their branch and landed right in front of Lumpur. Still stuck together, they lay on the ground looking stunned from the fall. Lumpur pointed at them, chuckling, "Yeah, you see that? They were enjoying themselves so much that they became heedless. Now they've fallen down and hit the ground. It hurts." So that was very much a situational teaching that Lumpur would use. So I think I'll leave it there for today, on that note with the lizards. Also, actually, Ajahn Sundra talking about Sotapanna, there's another in Waropano's wonderful book called Venerable Father. He was a New Yorker, so he was extremely, even more forthright than most of the other foreigners. So if he had a question he wanted to ask or something that he felt upset about, he would sort of challenge Lumpur, he'd ask something, kind of, and so in Venerable Father he recounts that one time he sort of worked up his courage and asked Lumpur a question about what actually is Sotapanna, how can you really recognize the qualities of Sotapanna? And he said Lumpur just turned to him and looked at him and said, "Sotapanna is fish sauce." And then that was the end of the conversation. And so in Venerable Father, there's like, fish sauce, what, huh? He doesn't, he just sort of leaves it hanging there in the book because it's like, was that some kind of esoteric transmission? Or does it mean that it's got no substance but it's got flavor? Or he just sort of has got no idea what it's supposed to mean, because that was, Lumpur just said, "Sotapanna is fish sauce," and that was the end of the delivery. A number of years later, a friend of ours was in Thailand and was at a little kind of noodle shop in Bangkok, and there on the table was a bottle of fish sauce, and what was it called? Sotapanna. So it was actually a brand of fish sauce. It was called Sotapanna. So Lumpur was being quite truthful. Sotapanna is fish sauce. So that would be the kind of insightful and astute teaching, but he wasn't always going to spell things out for you. So. Okay, I think that's enough for today.